Okay, so maybe I guess we can start. And tonight I'm going to talk about pretty much the same thing as Abraham talked about last week. Is that okay? I just found out in the couple of hours ago that Ajahn Brahm talked about the same thing I was going to talk about tonight, so that'd probably be okay. So you, the nice thing about that is that everyone is a bit different, I guess slightly different angles on the same thing. So you have you kind of get a different viewpoint, and that's always useful. The more angles you have on something, the better you can kind of deal with the issues that you're talking about. And the thing that Ajahn Brahm was talking about last week, I understand, was about some of the troubles and things in the world. And there's always problems in the world, and if you, especially perhaps these days, all kind of things going on. You have all the demonstrations around the world, you know, in connection with the climate problems, and then you have the demonstrations happening in Hong Kong, and then you have all the political problems, it seems, in the US and in the UK, and of course endless wars in many places like you, as you always have. So all of these things are kind of going on, and sometimes people write to us and they say, please talk about these issues because how can we deal with this? And these are very important points. How can we deal with these large issues in the world? And one of the great things about the Buddhist teachings is that it is a very kind of broad picture teaching, and for that reason it has a lot to say about these things. So how do we deal with these things? And there's three different ways of dealing with this, or non-ways of dealing with this, or whatever you want to call it. It depends what you mean by dealing with. But one way of dealing with it, not dealing with it, is just to get sad and upset and depressed because, everything is kind of going bad, everything is going wrong, and what's going to happen in the future, and where are we all going to go? That is one way of dealing with it or not dealing with it. It's just, and it's kind of natural that this happens because you feel that your future is threatened or whatever. Another way of dealing with it is to try to do something about it, to take part in demonstrations or write to people or do some kind of something which you feel is constructive. That's kind of the second way of doing something. And then there is a third way, and the third way is the way which is kind of the paramount Buddhist way of dealing with all of these issues. And that, of course, is going to be the main topic for the talk tonight, how to look at this from a Buddhist perspective. So let's just very briefly, the first way or non-way, just to feel sad or depressed about the world, which in many ways is quite natural. You can see why people feel upset about these things. And of course the reason is because so much of our lives are about the future, a vision of the future, about where we want to go, what we want to be. Every time we desire something, every time we have an attachment to something, which is pretty much all the time, it is about the future. And because so much of our life is about the future, when the future is kind of threatened by all of these things, it also has to do with having children, of course, and looks and kind of seeing the hope kind of fading away for future generations or whatever. And all of that, it seems terrible, and it's easy to get upset by it. But it's not very helpful. It doesn't really get us anywhere. And much better to try to find a way of thinking about this, which takes away some of those unpleasant emotions, and something which actually instead enhances your practice, even kind of is useful for your meditation practice, not just your meditation, but the whole Noble Eightfold Path, if you like. The second way of dealing with this is to do something about it. Whatever it is that you want to do. These days people seem to be really keen on demonstrations. There's demonstrations happening everywhere around the world, especially the climate kind of demonstrations have been very big in large parts of the world. Is that a Buddhist way of doing things? Well, actually, it is neither Buddhist nor not Buddhist. I think it's perfectly given, depending on how we do these things. I think some demonstrations are sometimes okay. I must admit, personally, I quite admire people who kind of get into the streets and demonstrate. As long as they have a good heart, they do it in a good way. I admire that. It takes a lot of guts to get out there. And maybe be arrested because what they do. They do things that are maybe kind of a little bit on edge of what is acceptable sometimes, like lying down in the street or whatever. But I find it quite fascinating that people do these things, and I find it quite brave and interesting. So in that sense, I personally, I don't have any problem with that at all. In fact, sometimes when there are big moral issues like climate change, which are not really addressed properly by governments or whatever, I would think it is a moral thing to actually do this. I think it's good as long as you do it in the right way. And that is really the critical thing here. So what is the right way of going about demonstrations? The right way of going about demonstration, of course, is to do it with a good intention. You do it with intention of compassion for other people. You do it with intention of loving kindness for future generations. You do it with intention of creating more peace and harmony in the world. And not, you don't come from anger because you're angry with the government or you're angry with the polluters or whatever. That is not really a good way of going about demonstration. Why? Because it just creates more disharmony and more problems down the road, down the track. Yeah. That is the Buddhist way of demonstrating. Yeah. And what is interesting, I read an article quite recently on demonstrations, what kind of demonstrations actually work. And this article, they had looked at a large number of demonstrations around the world, of course, starting, I think, or at least including the famous demonstrations that were led by Mahatma Gandhi in India, that led to the liberation of India from the British. And what they found was that the most powerful kind of demonstrations were always the peaceful demonstrations. These are the ones that work. And I think the reason why they work is because if you are peaceful, you tend to get the population behind you because people support you. If people see that you are good people with good hearts, you do this because you feel that there is a massive emergency, we have to do something, and you do it in the right way, not really blaming anybody, just making a statement about the problem, then, of course, it becomes something positive and you get the population behind you. So this is how it works. If you want these things to work, you have to do it the right way. And it turns out that the Buddhist way of doing it, with kindness, with compassion, with understanding, is the most powerful way of doing these things. Sometimes you hear people who are kind of activist-minded, and they will tell you that, well, anger is good because anger gives you energy. Yeah, and I always think that when I hear that, I always feel a bit disheartened because to me, it is completely the wrong way of going about any kind of activism, whether it's demonstrations or whatever it is. It is wrong because for two reasons. First of all, anger is not sustainable. The energy that we get from anger is not sustainable. It will only last for a certain while. Then you will deplete your reserves of energy completely because anger burns up the energy. Eventually the energy is gone. Yeah, it takes a lot of energy to sustain the anger. When the energy is gone, you have nothing to carry on with. The far more powerful energy is the positive energy of the mind, the energy of compassion, of kindness, because that energy is sustainable. It doesn't die out eventually. It comes from purity. It comes from something positive inside. If you see someone who is a very holy person, occasionally might get a glimpse of someone who is very developed in the meditation or whatever, they have a very positive mind and they're also incredibly energetic. Positive mind states and high mental energy always goes together. That's why Ajahn Brahm tells so many jokes. That is one of the reasons. Positive mind, lots of energy. 1 + 1 = whatever. But anyway, that's kind of what Ajahn Brahm is all about. Yeah, he's got very good meditation and that leads to jokes and energy. That's two things it leads to. It leads to other things as well. And the other reason why anger doesn't work, why it is really problematic, is because it is deluding. When you're angry, you don't see things straight. This is one of the basic ideas of Buddhism, that the defilements of the mind, they delude you from seeing reality, seeing things straight, seeing things the way they actually are. Anger bends the truth, as does desire. When you're angry, you think you should be doing certain things that you would never think if you were not angry. Anger always bends the truth. One of the very profound and important insights of Buddhism. And this is why you have to reduce these defilements of the mind to be able to take correct action. This is so important when if you're going to demonstrate against something, because if you get angry, suddenly you think violence is okay. Why? Because of the bigger cause. Yeah, of course it's okay to be violent. Well, the policeman, you know, didn't stop me from doing what I want to do, so I can't be violent back or whatever. And this is where the anger gets you in trouble. And then the whole demonstration, everything you do, gets damaged because you're doing it in the wrong way. And it doesn't work anymore. So don't go down that track. It's not the Buddhist way of doing things. And it destroys the credibility of the entire protest movement that you have. So I would say that if you're going to protest, do it in the right way. If you do it in the right way, with a good heart, I don't see any problem with it. In fact, I think there's a lot of bravery in that. If you look at the history of demonstrations, you look at Mahatma Gandhi. At the time, he was considered a terrorist by the British, you know, overlords in India. But of course, history has judged him very, very kindly, as one of the great saints, almost, of modern history. And he was a great example of how peaceful demonstration can lead to wonderful results. So demonstrations, wherever you do them, should be done in the right way. And of course, from the government side, the government also has an obligation to treat demonstrators in the right way, not to treat demonstrators badly. If the government treats demonstrators the wrong way, it's the government that is at fault and does something wrong. This is how you can judge in any case, whether it is the demonstrations here in Australia or even in Hong Kong or whatever it is, how you can judge whether people are acting appropriately or not. Make it peaceful. And then, when it's peaceful, there is a chance of dialogue. There's a chance of resolving these things in a constructive way between the different parties. So this is the two ways, if you like, of dealing with these problems, or whatever you want to call it. But there is a third way, and this is the way that, to me, is really interesting, because this is the truly spiritual way. Whether you should demonstrate or not, whether you should do something or not, is really up to you. It is not really a spiritual question. It is what values you have and all of these kind of things that decides this. But this third way is really the kind of deep Buddhist way. And you can combine this with the other ways if you like, but this is the deep Buddhist way. And the deep Buddhist way is to understand that the world going wrong, the world not going according to your desires and to your attachment, is exactly what you should expect. This is the nature of the world, that the world goes wrong, that the world goes in ways that are unpleasant, that there are wars coming, that you have climate changing, that you have governments doing the wrong thing, that you have strife and problems in the world. This is what we can expect. And the reason why this is so problematic for us is precisely what I mentioned before. We have so much vested interest in a certain future, in the future being in a certain way. We have built up so much in this world. We have a nice home, perhaps. We may have a family. We have invested in our career, worked really hard to make things work. We have built up something for us in our life. And because of that, we have a vested interest in the future. We have an attachment to the way things are. And then when the world seems to go wrong, when it goes contrary to our attachment, contrary to our desires, contrary to all the things that we have built up, it becomes very difficult and very hard to deal with. And that is the real problem. Our interest in the world is opposed to the way the world actually is. So we have to remember this. It's such an important lesson in life. This is the nature of the world. When the Buddha talks about the idea of impermanence, when he talks about the idea of things being unreliable, things being out of control, and all of this is talked about in a number of places. One of the key terms, of course, is the idea of anicca in the Pali language, which means impermanent. It means not steady, something always flickering and changing, something out of control, basically. This is the way of the world. If we try to make the future be in a certain way, if we have expectations for the future, if we think that we can fix the world in a certain way, we're always going to be disappointed. From Buddhist point of view, it is a foolish idea to have fixed views about the future, because if you have fixed views about the future, you're going against the nature of things. So the world is a pretty harsh place in this sense. Yeah, we never know what to expect around the corner. We never know whether we're going to be able to fix up the climate problems or whether they're going to get worse. We never know where the world is going to end up in a massive war and everywhere we're going to kind of wipe out 90% of the population. These things are all possibilities. Some of them probably slight and other things far more possible. And if you look at the situation in Hong Kong, for example, people are demonstrating here. But really, if you're going to be realistic about what's happening in Hong Kong, then of course the government is going to be far more powerful than a demonstrator. And eventually it will lead to, they are the ones who are going to win this sort of fight. Sometimes you just have to be realistic about this. Change is coming. Change is inevitable. And sometimes you can't stop it. When you see that, when you're able to accept the idea of change, things just moving along, things never being certain about the future, something beautiful happens. What happens is that you start to go with the flow. There is much less resistance there inside of you to how the world is. And when you go with the flow of things, things tend to become easier. Things tend to become lighter. There is much less burden in life because you're able to negotiate things the way they are. When things suddenly change, you think, yeah, I expected that. I expected that because I know, I understand the Buddhist teachings about everything. Everything in the world being changeable, unpredictable, never know what's going to happen around the corner. Going with the flow is such a powerful idea. When you see the news on television and you think politicians are doing stupid things, you shrug your shoulders. You say, okay, of course they do stupid things. They're just humans like everyone else. Human beings do silly things. That's the nature of human beings. And in this way, you can live in peace with things. This does not mean that you shouldn't do anything. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't take part in activities that counteract the problems of the world. This doesn't mean that you shouldn't be promoting peace. You shouldn't be promoting a good climate. You can very well do all of these things and at the same time have this broader outlook. But you do it with different values. You don't do it from anger. You don't do it because you are certain that you will succeed in changing things. You do it because out of kindness, out of a sense of care for future generations and also for care for yourself and everyone else. And if you come from that, you can never really lose. Because if it turns out that your demonstrations and your activities don't change anything, you can shrug your shoulders. Of course, that was kind of expected anyway. If your activities actually do make a change, it's a win-win situation. You've built up good qualities inside of yourself. At the same time, you have helped the world move in a good direction. So this is really what it is all about. This is that big picture. The future always being so unreliable. Don't invest too much in having a fixed view about the future. What happens when we do this? Our perceptions start to shift. The shift, instead of taking the world too seriously, instead of focusing on results in the world, instead of focusing on outcomes like, how successful you're going to be in business or how what the world is going to look like down the track or how much material acquisitions you have made and all of these things or the status that you have. Instead of looking at these things and making these things the core of your life, you understand these things are unreliable because they depend on external forces. And these external forces is not something that is ever going to be under your control. So you withdraw some of your interest in that. And you do it gradually. You do it gradually because if you withdraw your interest in the world too fast, again, it can become depressing because you haven't got anything else to take its place. But you start withdrawing interest in the world where there is no real possibility of securing any certainty about the future. And instead, you start to look for meaning somewhere else. Where is that somewhere else? In the spiritual life. The spiritual life means development of your inner qualities, development of your mind. This is one of the important things that we do in meditation practice. Not just meditation practice, but the entire spiritual life. Because you understand that there is one place where I can make a difference, and that is how I behave, what my intentions are, how I relate to the world. That is a place you can actually do something, but the external world is out of control. The more you reflect on this, becomes incredibly powerful, because this idea of withdrawing your interest from this external world, it changes entirely your direction in life. It becomes a very powerful force after a while. And you start to think about life in an entirely different way. The world goes this way, you go the exact opposite way. This is one of the signs of the Aryas, the noble people, that they go in exactly the opposite direction of everyone else. So if you see someone who's doing strange things and walking against the stream, when everyone goes to A, they go to minus A, you know this person might be a noble individual because they're doing something very hard to do. So look for the people who are going to minus A. Yeah? If you see someone going to minus A, you know that might be a noble person. Where is minus A? Well, it's the opposite of everyone else. So this is the idea, how we change things, and we start to look at things in a different way, and we start to imbue our life with spiritual qualities. What does this mean in practice? And in practice, it may not mean any great external changes in your life. You may still continue to do roughly the same thing, having the same family life, having the same job maybe, whatever it is, the same hobbies, the same interest, still coming to Dhammaloka Center to meditate on Friday nights, yes, or whatever else it is, having the same habits, doing the same things. But you do things with a different intention. Inside your mind, something has changed. What has changed is that instead of looking for results in the external world, instead of looking for how much career you're going to have, how much money you're going to make, how much status you're going to acquire, how much friendships or relationships you have, or whatever else it is, you start to look at the quality in these things. What is the quality I put into my activities in the world, the qualities I put into my family life, the qualities I put into work, the qualities I put into coming here to the Buddhist Society of WA. That becomes the important thing. You look at the process, what do you, instead of the results. The results become less important because they're out of control anyway, but the process you can do something about, that becomes your life instead. And it's a massive change. Externally, nobody may be able to tell much about you, that something has changed, but internally, it's a big turnaround, moving in a new direction. And people will see it. They will see it because you're becoming more content, more happy, more relaxed as a person, less tense, less care, less interested in all the worldly goals in the world, which are out of control anyway. Something beautiful happens when this happens, something beautiful starts to happen inside of you. You become more peaceful, more calm. When you're less interested in worldly goals, it becomes much more easy to be peaceful on the meditation seat. Why? Because you stop thinking about these things, because you understand they're actually quite irrelevant, because they're out of control anyway. So this is how to think about the world, and how this transforms your very relationship with life, your very relationship with everything that happens around you. A very powerful example of this that happened to me quite recently, during the rains retreat. I'm not sure if you are aware, but we had recently had a 3-month rains retreat at Bodhinyana Monastery. They also had it at the Dhammasara Monastery. And this is when the monks and nuns kind of retire a bit from, teaching and traveling and all these kind of things. We withdraw a little bit more from the world, focus more fully on spiritual matters. And this year, during the rains retreat, my sister happened to die from cancer back in Norway. Norway is where I was born. It's where I come from originally. She happened to die. She had been sick for many, many years. It was kind of expected, yeah? But of course, when it happens very fast. Bang! And she's gone. So I had to go back to Norway, and I conducted the funeral for her, which is a very nice thing to be able to do to your family members. Conduct a funeral, say a final goodbye to your family members. It's a powerful thing, by the way, to be able to conduct a funeral in a setting which is completely non-Buddhist. Yeah, I'm the only Buddhist in my family, really. Everyone else, I don't know what they are. They're kind of leaning towards Buddhism, yeah, but they're not really Buddhist. And my sister was kind of the least Buddhist of all of them. So everyone who comes to the funeral, and it was a big funeral, I don't know, 300 people or something, lots of people, and none of them Buddhist. But what is so fascinating about the Buddhist teachings, because I conducted it, because I gave the talk at the ceremony, you have this opportunity to talk to people about, who are not Buddhist, about Buddhist things. And the reaction is so powerful. People think, wow, I didn't know Buddhism was about this. This is really cool stuff. I've been to so many funeral ceremonies, most of them kind of Christian or or not even Christian. A lot of them today are kind of secular Buddhist funeral ceremonies. And people say, oh, they're so sad, yeah, so terrible, they would not really feel or learn anything. But this one, this is like an uplifting funeral ceremony. And people feel uplifted after a funeral. That's kind of nice, isn't it? If funerals can be uplifting, then, you know, that something has really changed in the world. It's wonderful. And it tells me when I do that, that the Buddhist teachings have something very powerful, a very powerful message for the world at large. People are actually impressed and inspired by these teachings. The hard part is often to get people's ear, to actually be able to hear what is going on. Once they hear it, they find it very powerful and very useful. So that is often the biggest thing, is to kind of reduce the entry barriers, yeah, get the message out there so that these wonderful teachings can have more impact on people's lives. But the real point was how powerful it was, in a sense, to have a family member who dies. We read about people dying in the newspaper all the time, and it's kind of distant. Yeah, people are dying in Syria. Okay, next article. Yeah, you go on to the next thing. You don't really think about it, because after a while you get kind of... You can't have emotions about these things all the time. Otherwise, you'd be overwhelmed by emotions. If every time you see someone dying in the newspaper, you're going to be sad and cry or whatever. It's going to be terrible. So after a while, you don't feel anything. It's, okay, next article, please. Thank you. And, you know, it's terrible, but that's the way it has to be. Otherwise, we just can't live. But there's something about when someone in your family dies that is incredibly much more powerful. And the reason why it is so powerful is that it's no longer just a name in a newspaper. It's no longer a statistic in some kind of book about all the people who died in the war of Syria or whatever. Now it's real. You know this person. You know their life story. My sister had 2 children. Yeah, both teenagers, the fairly late teens, so they're fairly okay. It wasn't a big problem. She had I know exactly, you know, of course I know everything about her pretty much. All her relationships over the years. All the things that she has been doing, and what she was doing towards the end was kind of repairing and refurbishing this old farmhouse that was over 200 years old. Put years and years of work into this farmhouse. And in the middle of this refurbishment, this was kind of her main project in life towards the last 10 years or whatever. In the middle of this project, she dies. It's gone. Everything is finished. The project of her life was never really finished. Yeah, she never really got where she wanted to get to. Her children kind of grew up, but not really fully. They were still teenagers, both of them. Yeah, still hadn't reached full maturity. That project too, she wasn't really able to see through. And when I saw this, when I saw her, and I didn't actually manage to speak to her before she died. I kind of got back to Norway a day or so after she had passed away. I got this powerful feeling of the futility of everything. You put your life into all of these things. Family, this big project that you have. You work really hard. My sister was this incredibly energetic person. Yeah, very, very hardworking. Full of positive energy. Always very generous and kind. Whenever I come back to her house, she would make lots of food for me. Yeah, she knows that monks, they don't cook themselves. And they're really hungry because they eat only once a day. She made this enormous thing for me. And I was kind of eating very happily. Very generous, always looking after me, very supportive, very towards the end she started to become interested in Buddhism as well, because she realized that there must be some other values in life than just the worldly values. She was a very worldly person in many ways. But then the futility of it, yeah, working so hard for all of this, in the middle of everything, she dies. And this is the story of our life. We're all like that. While we're in the middle of doing something, middle of finishing a project, middle of going somewhere, we die. It's over. What was the point? We never reached any real goal. We never really got anywhere. And even if you do finish your goal, even if you do finish that project of refurbishing this farm and making something out of it, straight away there's a new goal over the horizon. Why? Because you're not really content. You're not really satisfied with the way things are. You still want to carry on with something more. We're never finished. We're always moving on to something else. And in the middle of this process of moving on, we die. It's all finished. I was struck by this enormous sense of futility when I saw my sister, when I saw this happening to my sister, because it was so close to me. I knew all the details of her life. I felt, what's the point of this? It's kind of meaningless. Moving towards some imaginary future that doesn't actually exist, that never comes about. And all our lives are a bit like that, moving towards something imaginary, never actually comes about. Some kind of figment of our imagination, a pie in the sky that actually never can really happen. And this is the kind of fundamental problem of life, this future that actually never is achievable. And once you see that, you withdraw interest from these things. It's not interesting anymore. We have to do something else. And of course, that is what was happening with my sister towards the end of her life. She realized this is not going to go on. This can't carry on. So she started to get more interest in spiritual matters. And she started listening to meditation teachings, trying to meditate herself. Very hard for my sister to meditate. She was such an energetic and restless person, always doing things. But she tried. Gradually, she started turning in to a different direction. That's when it comes in very handy to have a brother who's a Buddhist monk. Yeah. So, please, give me some teachings about meditation. Okay, here you are. I sent her a mass of stuff on meditation and spiritual things. And I didn't send her any of my teaching, because I know it's difficult to listen to your own brother. I sent her all kind of other stuff, except anything from me, because it's always a bit iffy to do that. So it's very powerful. And sometimes we need these very powerful reminders. Death is a very powerful moment, especially if we come close to death of ourselves or a very close family member comes close to death, because then we really start to understand what life is about. So the idea of reflecting on death is very, very useful in this on the spiritual path, because it brings out these kind of contemplations about the futility of it all in the end. We need to look somewhere else for meaning, and that somewhere else ultimately is, of course, the spiritual practice, the development of the mind, the development of the heart, the building up of good qualities inside. There is another way of looking at this that I wanted to bring up very briefly as well, and that is the Buddhist idea of time. And the idea of time, from a Buddhist perspective and also from a kind of largely from an Asian perspective, is very different from the kind of more Western cultural perspective on time. In the Western world, which is dominated by Christianity and perhaps Islam, in the Middle East you have Islam, the idea of time is basically linear. You have linear time. Why is that? And the reason is because the world kind of starts out here. Yeah, God creates the world, starts out here, and then kind of you go through all this whole process, whatever you're doing through this whole process, and then over here the world kind of comes to an end. This is like Judgment Day or whatever they call it. I don't know much about Christianity, but it starts over here and it ends over there. And then through that there's a process between that. This is what we call linear time. And don't forget that Christianity has a very powerful cultural influence on Western society, including Australian society, of course. So because of that, we have a very powerful image or idea of linear time as part of Western culture. So the idea here is that there is a kind of a purpose. Yeah, the world starts up over here and it ends over there, and we're moving towards this purpose, towards this goal, this aim, something in the future. This is, in a sense, what Western ideas of the world is like. And of course, that is not just about Christianity. It's about how we think about the cosmos. When Western scientists think about the cosmos, they think about the cosmos in exactly those terms, precisely because, I think, in part, because they are influenced by the Christian idea of linear time. So you have the Big Bang, the world starts over here, and then it goes through a certain process, and eventually it whimpers out somewhere over here. It's linear time on a much larger scale, of course, than the Christian idea of linear time, but still the idea of linear time, which pervades kind of the Western culture and Western ideas of things. But Buddhism and much of Asian culture, as I understand it, but I'm no expert, but this is just from my own kind of observations or whatever, there's the idea of circular time instead. We don't start out over here and end up over there. Instead, we are going around in circles. And one of those circles is the idea of rebirth. Yeah, you go from one life, you start out young, you become older and older and older and older, reach middle age, then you go downhill. That's where I am right now, going downhill faster. Yeah, downhill, 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 and eventually, bang, you die down here. And when you die, it's not the end of things. If it was the end of things, it would be linear time. It's the start of things again. You get reborn, and you start on the same cycle again. Come back to where you started. Make the same mistakes, yeah? Do the same silly things. Have roughly the same suffering. Do you want that? Is that good? This is why rebirth is bad, yeah? Precisely because of that. Around, and then bottom, again. And they go around like this, yeah? And after a while, you think, enough of this. This is kind of crazy to go around like this. So this is one idea of circular time, but there's also a much larger idea of circular time in Buddhism. And that's the idea of the entire cosmos, or the universe, going through cycles in exactly the same way. The universe goes through cycles of evolution, and then cycles of the opposite, which might be called maybe called dissolution or devolution or whatever it is. I'm not sure what it is called. The opposite of evolution. You evolve, evolve, and you devolve. Eventually, you come back to the point where you started. And then you have another universe. Yeah, and on it goes like that, in cycles and circles. And of course, when you think about the world in a linear way, it seems like there is a goal. Yeah, you're moving towards this goal there in the future somewhere because it's linear. You're heading towards that goal. When you look at world in a circular way, there is no goal anymore. It just keeps on going around, always coming back to the starting point. Maybe not exactly the same starting point, but roughly the same thing, yeah? It's not exactly circular, but it's roughly circular. Coming back to where you started, doing the same things over again, and again, and again, and again. The universe restarting, everything starting from scratch, everything having been destroyed in the meantime. And in this idea of circular time, sometimes we are deluded to think that the world is kind of moving somewhere because we have been, you know, if you look at recorded history, it looks like we have been going somewhere. Yeah, technology has improved rapidly. We understand the world much more through natural sciences and all of this. Yeah, so it looks like there has been an evolution. But it's only such a tiny time scale, 10,000 years or whatever it is, human recorded history. Well, depending how many fossils or whatever you take into account, but at least human history in terms of settlements and towns, maybe 10,000 years at the most. But from a Buddhist point of view, that's nothing. It's just a tiny speck in time. Yeah, and these enormous cycles of universes coming and going. And in that enormous idea of universes coming and going, there is no future. There is no evolution. You're not actually going anywhere. There's no end point. There's no omega point. Yeah, the omega point is kind of the last letter of the Greek alphabet. Omega, kind of the end point of everything. This comes to a stop. There is no omega point. It's just the restarting again and again and again. And when you look at world in that way, from more of the Buddhist perspective, it actually starts to become quite meaningless. It's pointless. Yeah, going around and around and around. What's the point of that? Nowhere to go. No future, no goal. Nothing to really aim for. Just coming back, doing the same stupid, silly, whatever, meaningless thing again and again and again. There's no point in that. And this is kind of the Buddhist idea. This is the idea of circular time and how it actually changes our attitude to the world in a very profound sense. Because we're not actually going anywhere. And if we're not going anywhere in the external world, we need to go somewhere inside of us instead. That is where there is a real journey to be had, in your own psyche, by developing your own mind, by living a good life, and by going somewhere inwardly, having a rich inner life that you develop over time. That is the only thing that is truly worthwhile. Because everything else is kind of not going anywhere. It's just an illusion of progress when actually not going anywhere at all. I hope this doesn't sound too dark to you. Does it sound terrible? Don't make too much out of this. But if it sounds terrible, just take it on board gradually and slowly. Yeah? And as you take it on board gradually and slowly, and you shift your focus, you find a new meaning in things. You find a new purpose in life, which is far more enriching than the purpose we had before in any case. People say that Buddhism is pessimistic. It is from talks like this that this comes out, yeah, that Buddhism is pessimistic. It has a negative view of the world. But that's missing the point. It's not about whether Buddhism or the spiritual path is pessimistic or not. That's completely missing the point. The point is whether it's realistic. That is the point. If you have some kind of false optimism, guaranteed you will suffer enormously because you're looking at the world in the wrong way. Of course not going to work out. That's the worst thing you can do. First of all, we have to be realistic about the world. We know how unreliable the world is, how it's all going in, kind of going randomly here and there. So this is a realistic outlook. Once you have a realistic outlook, which really is just about right view, looking at things in the right way, then you find a new way of thinking about life, a new way of dealing with things, then you can be optimistic because you found a solution to the problem. So this is the idea. This is how we change our outlook. This eternal running around doesn't make any sense anymore. There's a beautiful simile in the suttas. And this is the simile of the beings of the universe. It said beings are kind of wandering and roaming around. Yeah, from life to life, you're roaming and wandering around, samsara. The ancient Indian word of samsara means like this eternal cycle of just going on from life to life. And through this cycle of life to life, you're roaming and wandering. And it's a beautiful word, this idea of roaming. This is a good translation of the Pali word behind this. Because the word roaming, what does to roam mean? Roam means not to have any destination. Yeah, you're roaming around the forest or roaming around the city. This is kind of walking randomly through the streets or whatever, not without destination. That's what it means. And that's what life is like. It's this roaming, not really going anywhere, not having any purpose, not having any goal. So stop roaming. Instead, come to the Buddhist path, or come to the spiritual path. You don't even have to call it Buddhist. Develop your mind, and then you are on the track, away from this roaming around. So this is just an alternative idea, this idea of time being so different. And it's interesting how a simple difference like the idea of time can have such profound consequences for how we think about the world, just thinking about time in a slightly different way. But what does all of this amount to? And what all of this amounts to really is just the idea of right view. Looking at the world in the right way. Yeah, and you will notice that the Buddhist idea of right view is very often very different from the worldly idea of right view. Don't focus on the worldly results. Focus instead on your intentions, on how you live, rather than what you achieve. Then you will have a full and meaningful life as a consequence. And there's a beautiful saying in the suttas. Suttas is the word of the Buddha, by the way. The Buddha says that what is suffering, or what is suffering for an ordinary person, ordinary people, is happiness for the noble people. What is suffering for the noble people is happiness for the ordinary people. It's almost the exact opposite. Where the worldlings pursue worldly aims, these things are pointless and meaningless for the spiritual people, noble people, yeah, because they instead pursue the inner qualities instead. That's where they find real value. It's almost the exact opposite way of looking at the world. This is the kind of the power of this. In another place, the Buddha talks about what he calls the Sabbaloka Anabirakkisanya. It's one of those beautiful little teachings in the suttas that you probably many people have never heard of before. And Sabbaloka Anabirakkisanya sounds kind of impressive in its own right. Just the word sounds impressive. It's a long word with many syllables. Sabbaloka means the whole world. Anabirakti means non-delight. And sanya means perception. It's the perception of non-delight in the whole world. Withdrawing your interest from the whole world and instead focusing on the inner qualities instead. This is one of the perceptions actually to be developed on the Buddhist path. That is what I've been talking about today. This withdrawal of interest in that world which is so out of control. You don't know what's going to happen next, and that is the problem. So what happens here when you develop that right view? There's only one aspect of right view I've been talking about now, but a very powerful one in my opinion, because it changes your entire priorities in life. The development of that right view means that we have new values. We value things in a different way. We value different things in life. Because our values are different, we prioritize different things. If you have right view, and the stronger this right view is, when you go out, back to work, back to your family, whatever it is, and you have this right view at the back of your mind, yeah, it's in there. The stronger it is, the more at the back of your mind it's going to be. And because it is at the back of your mind, when you come into a difficult situation where it's easy to lose your temper or lose your cool or whatever, then instead, because that view is there to guide you, it reminds you, do what is right. Remember what matters in the world. What matters is not the outcome, whether other people like you or not. Who cares? Whether they, even if they treat you badly, it's their problem. It's nothing to do with me. And you remember these things. It changes your ability to be kind and caring in all situations in life. But it is difficult to always live morally. It's difficult to always think in the right way, to think with care and compassion, to have loving kindness in difficult situations. And the only way we can really do this is to empower the right views. The right view stands at the back of everything and reminds us of the importance of these things. The more powerful your right view is, the more ability you will have to do the right thing, moment after moment, day in, day out. And then you will have incredible success on the spiritual path. Because that is really the, if you like, the holy grail of Buddhism. Is the, if there is such a thing as the holy grail of Buddhism. But the holy grail of Buddhism is to be able to be, live morally, live with kindness. That is where things really start to happen. This is the source of everything else. Successful meditation, successful insight, and everything else on the path. And what supports that in turn is right view. Another thing that right view supports is our meditation practice. If you come into this hall on a Friday night, and it's difficult to meditate on a Friday night, I don't know why we have these meditations on Friday night. We've just been working for 5 days, flat out. Everything's been really hard, and all you want to do is go to sleep. And then you come here, and you have to, and that's why some people snore, Who was that snoring here before? We had some snorings going on. And what do we expect? Of course people are going to snore, It's to be expected. And I always have a sense of compassion for people when they snore. It means that they're not self-conscious, they're just, and everyone else listens to them. And it's nice to have compassion when people snore, because someone is really relaxing and enjoying themselves. What a wonderful thing that is. So it's really the wrong time to have meditation practice. But anyway, my point really is that if you are able to get something out of these meditation sessions, good on you, because it's not so easy. But if you are, then you will notice that whenever you meditate, whenever you get into meditation a little bit, the mind tends to think about things. That is one of the biggest problems in meditation practice. We think about our work, we think about our family, we think about problems, we think about endless kind of things. And if you haven't got anything else to think of, you will confabulate some amazing, silly, stupid thing just to be able to think about something. This is how the mind works. So to be able to stop that, to stop the mind, some of the people I think are a bit afraid of telling about their thoughts because they think their thoughts are so silly and so useless. But we are all like that, so don't worry about it. But the point is that if we withdraw our interest from the world, if we see that there is no goal there, it doesn't really get you anywhere, then all this thinking about resolving the problems in the world, the problems in your life, whatever it is, it's not going to be interesting anymore. Because you know, as soon as you resolve this problem, there's going to be another problem waiting to pop up behind it. It's endless. There is no end to problems. There's no solutions to all these problems. And because of that, there's only one thing to do. Withdraw your interest from that area. Understand the world is out of control. Then there is a chance of peace in your mind. Instead, emphasize, prioritize the spiritual path, because that is where there are real solutions, that where something can actually happen in your life. So right view is very powerful in allowing your mind to become peaceful, because you value the right thing here. You don't value the things in the world that have no solution, where there actually is no real future, certainly not the future that we tend to imagine that there's going to be. And then you can see how right view becomes such a powerful force on this path. But remember, right view, like everything else, has to be developed. You need to think about this, you need to reflect on it, you need to take it on board. Is this really true? This monk over there, what is he saying? Is he saying talking nonsense perhaps? I need to think about this. So think about it. Make it your own. If it is true, make it your truth. Yeah, and then when it becomes your truth, when you reflect on it, when you develop this idea, it starts to have a power in your life. You really start to give up that interest in the world, at least in a kind of attached way. And then it starts to work in your spiritual practice. When you close your eyes, you couldn't care less about that world anymore, because now you're doing something far, far more important than anything that you do in the external world outside. This is how it works. So this is the idea of right view. And if you know a little bit about the word of the Buddha, you know the Noble Eightfold Path, the eight factors that lead to all the way to the end of the Buddhist path, to awakening and all of that. You know, the very first factor of that path is right view. Now you know why it is so important. And now you know why that it is not just about saying, yes, I believe in rebirth. Yeah, that's not really what it's about. It's about a deep appreciation of what the world really is like and how that affects our values, our understanding and our priorities in life. And then when there are wars coming next, and I'm sure there will be wars around the world, when there is more political problems, and there will be, guarantee you, more political problems, when there is more climate problems, and it seems to be getting worse and worse all the time, and it's going to get much worse before it gets better in the future as well. When these things happen, instead of despairing, instead of being sad, you have something else. You think about these things in the right way. You understand the world's out of control, and you start to refocus in a different way, think about things in a different way. Then life again becomes meaningful, and you don't despair about these things. Okay, that is the talk for tonight. Okay, so, okay, thank you very much. So before we take the questions from outside, let's see if anyone here has any comments or questions or complaints or whatever. Please, this is your chance. So, over there. Ah, Drew. Drew right here. Okay. Yeah.
Thanks, Ajahn. Good talk. I agree with everything you said in the talk, but there was a logical conclusion I was thinking of. So if Western thought is linear for time and Eastern thought is circular, what does that mean for the spiritual path? Does that mean the spiritual development of a person is circular?
Okay.
I've got an idea, but I'd like to hear yours.
Yeah. Well, it can be. Yeah, this is the problem. It can be circular. Yeah. And this is the thing. And this is... But the point, of course, is that you want to get out of that circular motion. You want to kind of, it's like a wheel. This is kind of why we talk about the wheel of samsara. You want to get off that wheel. That's kind of the whole point, because it is meaningless. So the spiritual path, if you don't practice it fully, don't take it to the end, it may very well be circular. You gain some wisdom in this life. You think you're wise. Do you think you're wise, Drew?
Not yet. Work in progress.
Work in progress. Okay, but you know, all of us have some wisdom, otherwise we wouldn't be here. So there's a little bit there. But we can lose it again. Yeah, who knows what's going to happen in your next life, and who where you're going to be reborn, what's going to happen next. And because of that, we can lose it again. That's the problem. In that sense, it can be circular. Yeah. And that's why there is a sense of urgency we're getting on with the practice to ensure that it isn't circular, but we actually carry on. We kind of, you know, we spiral a little bit, and one day, poof, we go off the whole thing. Yeah. And that's kind of the ultimate purpose of the path. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, anyone else? Yeah, Eddie, you are reliable. Okay, I'm glad there wouldn't be many questions here, Eddie, without you. I'm glad you are here. We have you here.
Ajahn Brahmani, It's very interesting to hear your talk on the current world problem.
Yeah.
Okay. Demonstrations, and you end up with right view. Yeah. You know not. See, the Buddhist way of solving problem is a peaceful way. Yeah. The peaceful way is through dialogue, you know. Yeah. It can be done, you know. Mm. Okay? And especially dialogue, if it cannot be solved between two people, there's always a third or fourth mediator, you know, who helps it.
Yeah.
But the problem with the world today, you know, is always that one side, you know, instigating, you know, they want to win, you know.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Like for example, it's through greed, you know, changing regime, this thing, you know. You know, or there's money in that country, this thing, so they want to win. They don't want talk, you know.
Yeah,
all right, yeah.
Yeah.
Or what the other thing is to dig up dirt, you know. They want to sort of like humiliate a country, this thing.
Yeah. You know?
Okay. Yeah. They dig up dirt, this thing, and no talk. They just want to sort of. That's what the demonstrations are in the world. It's not peaceful, and they don't want the peace, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think.
So that's the problem we have today, you know.
Yeah.
It's always that the outside interference.
Mm. Yeah.
If it's a really peaceful one, it can be solved quickly.
Good. You may very well be right. Sometimes there's too much anger and too many problems, and this is why one of the reasons why as Buddhists we should go ahead with be a good example to everyone else. At least we can do things in the right way, you know. So I think that if you take part in the protest and you are one of the peaceful ones, it means that you will kind of guide all the other protesters to also be peaceful, yeah, and in a way, because you will have that power to help out with creating peace in the world. So we have to remain the examples that are good. Otherwise, nobody else is going to do it. Yeah.
But the problem is that they don't want the peace.
Yeah.
They want to create the trouble.
So what is your solution?
What is that?
What is your solution?
That's I would say negative forces are taking over.
That's not the solution.
Yeah, and you find that I better be careful what I say.
Absolutely.
If you're not peaceful inside, you know, if the country is not peaceful inside, you can't express peaceful outside too.
Sure, yeah, of course, I agree. Yeah.
If you're not peaceful inside, you can't give the peace to the world.
Yeah. Yeah, so in a sense what you're saying is that we don't know what's going to happen next, and because we don't know, we have to be, it's the spiritual path becomes even more important. Yeah, absolutely. Anyone else? Okay, let's have a look at these pictures from questions from overseas. What? Sorry. Please. Absolutely. Yeah.
So how do you reconcile the Buddhist idea of not pursuing meaning in worldly outcomes in the way most people in the Western world live, where they pursue goals for themselves and their families?
Yeah.
Is it possible to find meaning in worldly outcomes, or should we cast aside our lives outside of spirituality and look towards our spiritual lives?
Yeah. Well, it is hard. It's hard to give up the search for worldly outcomes completely. You know, that's a long path, because our desires for these things are very deep-seated. So it's more like a gradual change. It's not something you do overnight. And okay, yesterday I was completely focused on money. Today I'm completely focused on kindness. It just can't do that. The mind is a gradual thing. Gradual change is required. So what you do, you start out on this path, you start reflecting on these things, and as you do that, there is a gradual movement changing, something changing inside of you. And then you see where that takes you. Yeah, that's really how it works. And as you change, new possibilities open up, new things, you know, new avenues for practice open up, and gradually you move away from worldly aims and more towards spiritual aims. But remember, it doesn't necessarily mean any big change in how you live. Yeah, you can live an ordinary life with work, etc., where you have some goals, etc., but you live it with values that are different. You focus more on being kind to your co-workers, to your customers, to everyone else, and instead of having a rat race where everyone is competing with each other, instead more cooperation, working together, trying to sort things out in a more cooperative manner. Yeah, at least you can be like that. But this is a gradual thing. Yeah. So it is not an absolute one or the other. The two can work together to some extent. And sometimes what you find is that if you work in an environment where people are very competitive, but you are not, very often you will be more successful. And the reason you will be more successful is because people won't be afraid of you. Yeah, they're going to be afraid of everyone else because they're competing really hard. Yeah, but the peaceful guy who's kind of friendly with everyone, nobody's going to be afraid of him or her. Yeah, you're going to be okay. I don't know, but I have some of the, I know at least some people have been very successful in business life, and some of the people I know have been the most successful have also been the people with really big hearts, people who are very peaceful, people who get good meditation practice. Yeah, these have been successful. Why? Precisely because they care, precisely because they're kind, precisely because they have strong spiritual values as well. Yeah. Okay. So let's have. This is terrible. Okay. Anyway, question number one. Anyway, from the UK, anger is a very strong emotion. Sometimes it comes out to put boundaries to something that is not right. I meditate every day, and I know when anger is arising. How do you stop it from arising? Yeah. Okay, so this is a very interesting question. And one of the interesting things about these questions, you will notice straight away, this person says, I know when it's arising. In other words, I am mindful of it arising, but not able to stop it. Yeah, he or she is asking, well, I know it's arising, but how do you stop it? That is a very powerful insight already, because it means that mindfulness is not enough. Mindfulness is not sufficient to overcome the negative emotions. Sometimes people think that as long as you are mindful, you will be able to deal with all these negative emotions. But actually, that is not the case. And the Buddha says as much in the suttas, in his words. So what do we have to do when anger arises is to shift our attention in a different way. The reason you are angry is because you're looking at the person in a certain way. You're looking at the negative qualities in that person. You're seeing the bad sides. You think they are unfair and then maybe they're hurting you or whatever. That is when anger is most likely to arise. So there's two things you can do. Either you shift your focus to the good qualities in that person. Yeah, and very often we get angry with people who are really good. Yeah, people got angry with the Buddha. Yeah, people got angry with the most holy people in the world. We always get angry with good people as well. And in a Buddhist society such as this, there are lots of good people. Lots of people who practice precepts, who practice kindness and generosity. And it's really a privilege to be able to be part of a Buddhist society such as this. So remember the good people, the good aspects of people in your life. When anger is about to arise, make those big good qualities big. Focus on them instead, and the anger is guaranteed to die down. The other thing that you can do, and this is instead of focusing on the good qualities, which really is about loving kindness, the metta practice, sometimes we have to have compassion, because sometimes people, we cannot see the good qualities in somebody. And when you cannot see the good qualities in someone, remember, they have a big, big problem. Someone who has all bad qualities have a massive problem in their life. Nobody is likely to like them. They're going to have enormous problems in their social life. They're going to build up lots of negative qualities inside, which they may carry on into the future, maybe future lives or whatever. From a Buddhist point of view, it's very, very bad news to have so many bad qualities. So instead of thinking about your own suffering when you are in the presence of someone who is difficult, think about what they're doing to themselves. Think about this person. They are in darkness. They are deluded. They have no idea what they're doing. And then you can have compassion for them instead. This is an incredibly powerful technique, because basically it means that people are not really in charge of themselves. They are conditioned by the world outside. And when they are conditioned in the world by the world outside, they do stupid things as a consequence of that conditioning. Very often they want to be kind, but they can't help themselves. That's kind of sad, isn't it? When people want to be kind, they want to do the right thing, but the conditioning is so strong that the bad things come out regardless. Then you can feel a sense of compassion for them, because you understand there's a deep problem inside. They have a much bigger problem than you have. All you have to do is bear the brunt of their emotions for a short time. So that is how you do it, and practice metta on the way. Practice metta will gradually overcome your anger, and then eventually, one day, you will find out that you are a less angry person, and what a wonderful thing that is. Second question is from Belgium, and is as follows. When I see people who are angry, I believe they are deeply scared and or hurt. So deep in fear and hurt that nobody is listening to each other anymore. But how to help? You are doing very well already. If you are able to see people who are angry in a positive way like that, as someone who is hurt and someone who has a problem, I think it's very true, because anger is a kind of hurt. Yeah, if you really understood anger, you would never want to be angry, because it is just painful, really, for yourself and for everyone. So you're already doing very well just by seeing that, being able to be around them. And just by being able to be around someone who is angry, if you're able to see them in this way, it means it's likely you are able to be peaceful around an angry person. And if you are peaceful around an angry person, very often you will function like a mirror. Yeah, because an angry person will expect a reaction out of somebody else. If somebody doesn't react, if they're just there, the angry person suddenly, they will start to reflect on their own conduct. This is what it means, that you kind of function as a mirror to the other person. Because they realize, wait a minute, what's happening here? Maybe I have a problem, yeah? The other person isn't reacting, yeah? So just by being cool and being calm already, you have done a great service for that person. Of course, down the track, if you can help them even further, that's great. The problem, of course, is that if you want to help them further, they have to be open for that. You cannot force people to get rid of their anger. But if they are open for being helped, then you can suggest some of the things I said in my previous answer to the previous question here about having compassion and having, you know, looking at things in a different way so that anger doesn't arise in the first place. Okay, now comes the tricky one. This is the last question. You will not believe who this question is from. This question is from Ajahn Brahm. So this question is from Ajahn Brahm and Venerable Chanda. Ajahn Brahm is in the UK right now, in the train from Devon. Ajahn Brahm asks me if I please can tell the stories of the eggs at the protest. So this is really unfair. This is a story I told. This is what happens in the monastery when you hang around a lot. You tell each other stories from the past that you're really embarrassed about, and then they tell you to repeat these stories in public many years afterwards. So, okay, because he has asked me, I'll tell you the story. I'm not sure if I might get imprisoned for this, but anyway, we'll. So this was in my student days. So that's about, how long ago is that now? That is over 30 years ago, maybe 32 years ago, something like that. I was studying at an engineering school in Norway, studying engineering. And one day we had this political rally coming to our city. This was in the city of central Norway called Trondheim. We had a political rally, and it was this far-right party, this kind of xenophobic party coming to town. And because the far-right party were coming to town and to give a public talk on the public square, they were all the left-leaning people. Yeah, they wanted to come out and demonstrate against the far-right party. So there was this potential clash. And because there was a potential clash, there were lots of police and everything present to make sure everything was calm and nice. And then this friend of mine, he said, well, you know, look, here is the perfect situation to create some havoc. What we should do, we should take a big pile of eggs, and we should carry these eggs down to this demonstration, down to this political rally, and we should have a big sign up saying eggs for sale. Yeah? And then all these left-leaning, anti-capitalist, left-leaning people, they will have to buy our eggs, yeah? And then we will kind of make fun of them, and then they will use those eggs to throw on the right-wing politicians. We'll make fun of them at the same time. We'll make fun of everyone, yeah? So he said, this is what we should do. So I thought, yeah, this is a really good idea. So we made a sign, yeah, eggs for sale, one egg, $1, make sure we had a big profit, yeah? And then big sign, and then a kind of big tray of eggs, and we started wandering down to this protest. As soon as we entered the protest, two big police officers came and dragged us to one side, pulled us into a police van, and said, what is this all about? And I, you know, when the police kind of drags you into the van, you become very humble very quickly. So then, you know, I said, oh, we are just students, we're just messing around, you know, not really doing anything on purpose. So they said, okay, fine, but, you know, we give a warning, no more of this from now on. But that was the story of the eggs from the political protest in Norway. And the next day, we had one of Norway's big, I think it's the biggest newspaper in Norway, they come to take picture of us and brought a big story about how students were selling eggs at a protest, at a political rally in Norway. That was great. That was the student days. Student days always, at least when I was young, they were really wild. We were really crazy in those days. And that was kind of the fun of being a student. Anyway, so I never took part in the protest. I just kind of tried to inflame it a little bit. That's what I tried to do. Okay, so that's all for tonight. It's very nice to see you all again. Let us pay respect to the